ETAW remained one of America's best-kept secrets, generating new insights into Soviet particle beam and laser weapons research. CKTAW's priceless intelligence did not come from an agent photocopying secret documents and loading dead drops in out-of-the-way locations. Neither did it arrive from the big technology of satellites with high-powered lenses. However, before it was over, the full spectrum of intelligence tradecraft and technology would come into play, from an orbiting satellite to hard-won covert experience acquired over nearly a decade of successful operations handling agents in Moscow. CKTAW was a wiretap on underground communications lines that linked the Krasnaya Pakhra Nuclear Weapons Research Institute in the closed city of Troitsk to the Soviet Ministry of Defense in Moscow. Data flowing via phone, fax, and teletype between the two facilities was recorded as it passed through a seemingly secure section of cable running beneath the streets of a Moscow suburb. Tunnels and tapped communications lines had been previously used against the Soviets. The Berlin Tunnel Operation, Operation Gold, in 1955-56, was conceived at a time when Soviet communications were mostly unencrypted and carried by underground telephone and telegraph wires. However, unprotected hardwired communications had fallen out of favor during the 1960s when governments and military commands adopted microwave links to communicate. These directional signals, transmitted from antenna to antenna in line of sight of each other, offered some security advantages. Though the towers were often visible, the directional transmission cone of the signals made them difficult to intercept without positioning an antenna between two towers, an espionage act that would have been impossible in Moscow. In the mid-1970s, officers monitoring the RF, radio frequency, spectrum in Moscow discovered mysterious microwave signals with no clearly discernible origin. Eventually identified as data from a link connecting the MOD headquarters to the Krasnaya Pakhra lab, the signals unexpectedly appeared during rainstorms and suddenly vanished when the rain stopped. Engineers studying the phenomenon concluded that the temporarily exposed signals were caused by an atmospheric anomaly combined with one of the city's unique architectural features. Apparently, the rain caused enough diffraction to send the secret microwaves ricocheting off Moscow's tin-roofed buildings. The combination of rain and century-old roofs essentially turned a precisely targeted transmission into something resembling a broadcast. Rain and tuning to the right frequencies were all that was needed to listen in on some of the Soviet Union's most closely guarded weapons development secrets. The intelligence windfall was short-lived. When the Soviets became aware their microwave transmissions were vulnerable to intercept, both from land-based and satellite collectors, the signals diminished and then eventually disappeared completely. U.S. analysts were certain that another, more secure communications link had been established, but did not know where it was located. Eventually, analysis of images from the new KH-11 satellite revealed that the Soviet military was laying communications cables in a trench running between Moscow and Troitsk. Launched in December 1976, the KH-11, the first space-based platform to use digital technology and transmit near real-time images, provided eye-in-the-sky images from Moscow whenever it was in position, and clouds did not obscure the target. Corroboration of the image analysis came when CIA technical and operations officers in Moscow exploited information from every possible human and technical source to confirm that the trench did in fact carry the new Krasnaya Pakhra signals. Closer examination of the route showed a series of manholes along the length of the buried communications link. The manholes were installed for routine repairs and security checks, but if the CIA could obtain access to the cabling from one of the manholes, perhaps the link could be compromised. The job of identifying the best potential access point fell to CIA field officers, who studied more than a dozen manholes along Varshavskoye Chaussee, Warsaw Boulevard, a busy thoroughfare near Moscow's Outer Ring Road. However, like all Moscow operations, any actions to survey the manholes required exacting planning. how many times could Americans travel to the target locations without alerting the KGB surveillance teams? Could clandestine photography of the sites be acquired? How closely could a manhole be examined without attracting attention? In the final determination, only a handful of ground reconnaissance and casing trips were authorized. Each trip, either on foot or by car, required detailed planning, disciplined tradecraft, and, perhaps most important, timing calculated to avert suspicion. For an American to drive along a particular stretch of road outside his normal pattern of travel 5 times in a week was certain to tip off the ubiquitous KGB watchers that something about the area was of interest to the CIA. The few authorized casing runs required the participants to create new patterns of travel and eventually took more than 2 years to complete. The essential casing photography was acquired with OTS concealed Tessina cameras. With high-altitude images, casing photos, and sketches, the Moscow office worked up a 3-dimensional view of the CKTAW target site, including close-ups of notable features. Target sites along the heavily trafficked Varshavskaya Chaussee were narrowed down as one target manhole after another was rejected. The specific manhole eventually selected for an entry point was in the worst possible location, except for the fact it was better than all the others. The area along the narrow tree line that bordered Varshavskaya Chaussee became one of the most carefully plotted and studied pieces of real estate on the planet. Details of the manhole, located just off the roadway, were painstakingly examined. Among potential problems were the worrisome 120-acre open field opposite the target and a hostile installation belonging to the 2nd Chief Directorate visible on a hill 2 kilometers away. One positive feature was the tree line that ran parallel to the roadway. Although less than 50 feet wide, its foliage offered good ground cover for approaching the manhole from May through October. Over several months, CIA officers covertly examined, photographed, and briefly entered the manhole. These operations allowed them to gauge the difficulty of removing its cover, measure the dimensions of the underground chamber, the depth of the groundwater at the bottom, and confirm that the communications cables were accessible from a small steel utility ladder set permanently into one wall. The Soviets had not only shielded the cables in lead, but also installed sensors and alarms to detect any tampering. To tap a cable clandestinely meant not touching the actual transmission wires or compromising the integrity of the lead sheath encasing them. Tapping the cable was a daunting challenge. So important was the potential intelligence carried over the line that in 1977, the CIA authorized an unprecedented, technically high-risk and costly development program to do just that. Technical expertise required coordination among multiple engineers to design and build the equipment and an interface among developers and operations officers who would install and service the equipment. The operation included several DDS&T offices, a DO division, and the National Security Agency. Management of CKTAW's technical development resided with the DDS&T's Office of Development and Engineering, ODE, the office responsible for satellites and other advanced technical sensor programs. The development team included several OTS engineers, with the operation eventually encompassing the Office of SIGINT Operations, the National Photographic Interpretation Center, and the DO's Soviet East European Division. The system's key component was a collar that surrounded the lead-sheathed cable and extracted the selected signals for capture by high-volume recorders at the site. The recorded signals were retrieved and returned to Langley, where sophisticated equipment deciphered and analyzed the electronic pulses. With the key technology still in development, the buzz of covert activity surrounding the target manhole continued. Memos, cable traffic, thick sheaves of casing photos, satellite images, operational proposals, and surveillance reports bounced between Langley and Moscow, with particularly sensitive documents hand-carried by couriers. Refining the operational details required hours of discussions in the conference rooms at headquarters and among case officers in Moscow. Over the course of the operation, CIA officers would make periodic clandestine entries into the manhole in preparation for the installation of the collar and recording device. Officers trained for these assignments in a full-sized replica of the underground chamber at the CIA's covert facility called The Farm. Rigorous sessions familiarized the officers with the operation's physical demands, allowed them to practice the tasks to be performed in Moscow, and assessed their capability for carrying out the assignment. Ken Sechrest was one of the OTS techs selected to enter the underground chamber. He would conduct a data sampling survey of individual communications cables to determine the one of greatest value. This critical phase of the operation would require Ken to remain alone inside the manhole for up to 2 heart-pounding hours. The timing for an entry into the manhole was planned when Ken's activity was least likely to be observed by a passerby on foot, in a passing car, or on a streetcar. Current schedules and routes of the metro, trolleybuses, and the elektrichka were collected and studied, along with the sometimes wildly inaccurate official and unofficial maps of the area. The mileage to the target area from the office and potential drop-off points were precisely measured, as were the exact distances and drive times during different times of the day. To ensure he did not raise suspicion when approaching the manhole, Ken would disguise himself as an ordinary Muscovite. However, given the dated style of fashion available in Moscow, an American purchasing new local clothing would attract suspicion, and shopping for used clothing would have been even more alerting to the watchers. So Eastern European apparel of the right size, style, and matched the season was purchased at flea markets and thrift shops in Vienna, East Germany, and Warsaw. The clothing was carefully inspected, cataloged, and packaged at Langley before shipment to Moscow, where it was stored in a secure area to preclude potential KGB attempts to tag and track the items. Ken arrived in the USSR in the summer of 1979 after completing a 6-month crash course in Russian. Among his fellow trainees was the senior operations officer slated to become CIA chief of Moscow. As part of his cover, Ken took an immediate interest in cultural activities of Moscow, never missed an opportunity to volunteer to show a visitor around the city, and spent as much free time as possible outdoors with his family. He filled their schedule with visits to tourist sites, cross-country skiing, and hiking. In short, he acted nothing like the intelligence officers depicted in the movies. Never an international man of mystery, surrounded with beautiful women, nor the toast of Moscow's small American community, Ken did not own a James Bond tuxedo. His car of choice was not an exotic Aston Martin, but a sensible Volkswagen bus. He rarely used his newly acquired Russian language, since Americans who spoke Russian came under closer scrutiny. Ken appeared to be the dedicated family man with a moderate taste for culture and a love of the outdoors, who enjoyed playing broomball during winter's short daylight hours and throwing darts in the evening. In reality, Ken's carefully selected cultural excursions and interest in the outdoors worked toward a single purpose: to build a persona that established a predictable pattern of activity that began on the day he arrived and would continue until he departed. As artfully engineered as a piece of spy gear, Ken's job, hobbies, and interests, all of those elements that make up daily life, were meticulously designed before he stepped off the plane at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. Like all other Americans in Moscow, Ken would be a potential target for surveillance and subject to assessment by the KGB. He would be closely monitored during his first weeks in Moscow for inconsistencies in the carefully crafted profile. It would not take much to catch KGB attention. One or two anomalies outside the normal pattern of activity would label Ken an intelligence officer, bringing continuous surveillance and compromising his operational value. Within a few weeks, Ken concluded that he fell into the KGB's middle tier of surveillance priorities, an American who would be accorded periodic surveillance at random intervals. Even this would most likely lessen over time, as surveillance observed him maintaining a consistent profile and pattern of activity in Moscow. One critical piece of Ken's activity was frequent family outings doubling as well-planned surveillance detection routes, SDRs. Whenever possible, Ken, accompanied by his wife and two small children, visited Moscow's Leso parks or forest parks on day trips. Large expanses of green, sometimes spanning hundreds of acres, these parks were a welcoming world away from the gray, soot-covered streets of Moscow's center and a logical destination for a young American family that loved the outdoors. Ken and his wife Sharon spent hours in the parks with their children, who were 4 and 7 at the time, picnicking, throwing frisbees, and hiking the long trails through the forests. The rucksack Ken carried became a familiar accessory to those who might have him under surveillance. The rucksack contained food, water, toys, and blankets for a day in the park. These excursions also provided a logical reason to visit all areas of Moscow, allowing Ken to familiarize himself with the roads, geography, and traffic patterns, as well as identify choke points, escape routes, and observation stops for planning future SDRs. On days when they happened to have surveillance, Ken, with Sharon's help, could practice identifying KGB vehicles, license numbers, surveillance tactics, and team members. On a spring morning in 1981, 5 years of operational planning, targeting analysis, satellite imaging, signals intelligence, and technical development culminated in one of history's most elaborately planned and expensive family picnics. Leaving home in the family's green and tan VW bus, Ken began a 20-mile trip that appeared identical to his past travel patterns. But in this instance, each road, each turn, and each stop was designed to detect and identify surveillance. In their ears, Ken and his wife wore small radio receivers for the OTS monitors secured in harnesses near their armpits and tuned to the KGB's 103.25 megahertz primary surveillance frequency. Ken also carried a second receiver, a 6-channel scanner that searched for any near-field transmissions from militiamen and the ubiquitous 7th Directorate. The inductive antennas looped around their necks were encased in soft fabric, concealed under their clothing, and transmitted the signals from the receivers to the earpieces no larger than the head of a Q-tip. The small earpieces were concealed by latex sculpted by OTS disguise specialists to match natural ear contours and colored to blend with Ken's and Sharon's individual skin tone. Each listened for the distinctive Russian word Dvadsat Odin, 21, which translated from KGB surveillance code meant, "I have the target in sight." If neither spoken numbers nor a series of clicks were heard, Ken could conclude with some confidence that surveillance was ignoring him that day. As the family drove toward the park, no words were exchanged about how Ken would spend the majority of the day or the possibility of surveillance. "We wouldn't say much, particularly with kids there," Ken explained later, "because at those ages, you never know what they're going to repeat or to whom." So they had to be totally unwitting about what was going on. Ken initiated a series of maneuvers designed to detect surveillance. Unlike action-adventure movies, where the hero eludes surveillance through a series of spectacular high-speed stunts, the reality of espionage for Ken was both more complex and prosaic. He did not zoom through intersections or make dangerous last-second turns to lose the followers. His driving had to fit the profile of a family man taking his kids in a van to a picnic. To any surveillance team that might have been watching, Ken took a more or less direct route to the park with all the speed his 4-cylinder family van could muster. Once he abruptly pulled off the road, grabbed a kid out of the back seat, and rushed into the tree line for an emergency potty break. He also missed a turnoff and circled back to get on the right road. There was also the need to study the map when momentarily lost. If a surveillance team had been following as he performed these common maneuvers, they could not have stopped without drawing Ken's or Sharon's attention. The surveillance teams of the KGB's 7th Directorate were known to drive distinctive cars, usually the larger Volga, which resembled a mid-sized Volvo, or the more compact Zhiguli, the Soviet version of a Fiat 124. Because only the KGB had automatic car wash equipment, their cars tended to be clean compared to other vehicles on the Moscow streets. Further, they boasted the luxury of windshield wipers, a valued commodity among those Muscovites lucky enough to own a car, and often stolen if the car was parked unattended. The SDR continued for more than an hour, with Ken using a variety of seemingly routine stops and turns to confirm any vehicular surveillance. Finally confident they were not being followed, Ken turned into a parking lot at the perimeter of the large park and pulled into a spot selected far in advance for the day's picnic. Ken purposefully avoided the section of the park popular among Americans, where KGB teams might already be watching other targets. If he was not being watched, he wanted to avoid walking into active surveillance of another target. The family walked a couple hundred meters into the park before Sharon spread out their blankets on the edge of a grove of trees. Ken and Sharon continued looking and listening for surveillance as he began a series of apparently innocent explorations into the woods. Like the vehicular maneuvers, these were also intended to force any watchers to betray their presence. After half an hour trying to enjoy the picnic lunch with his family and becoming reasonably certain surveillance was not nearby, Ken put on his well-used and stuffed rucksack, nodded to Sharon, and slipped into the woods. The wordless gesture told her that if he did not return by a certain time, she should load the children into the van and drive directly home. Using a prearranged signal, she would alert the chief that Ken had not returned as scheduled and was likely in some kind of trouble. The chief would immediately take action to minimize potential collateral damage to other operations and prepare the U.S. ambassador for the inevitable diplomatic blowback from the Soviet press, announcing another American spy had been caught attempting to destroy the peaceful relations between America and the Soviet Union. As soon as Ken left the family, he began an extended surveillance detection run. There was need to reassure himself that he was clean before changing to Russian clothing. As he well knew, the 7th Directorate did not always detain or arrest suspected intelligence officers during an operation, but rather continued to observe in the hopes of being led to an agent or dead drop site. Even then, the officer was often allowed to continue on his way as if nothing was amiss. That had happened to Penkovsky in late 1961. The 7th Directorate watchers first spotted a man suspected of passing material to Janet Chisholm, wife of MI6 officer Roderick Chisholm, inside a doorway just off one of Moscow's busy shopping streets. Rather than make an arrest, they increased surveillance and eventually spotted the same man a few days later in a public park making another exchange. The unidentified subject was then placed under surveillance and later identified as GRU Colonel Oleg Penkovsky. The spy, not the intelligence officer, was the ultimate target. However, once the KGB had identified an agent, arresting the foreign intelligence officer during an operation offered additional value. When the KGB arrested Martha Peterson on the Krasnolushki Bridge in 1977, although Trigon was probably already dead, her detention brought negative international publicity to the United States and disrupted CIA operations in the USSR. As Ken walked the paths of the park, the decision of whether to go to the manhole site was complicated by the number of people around him. Soviet citizens frequently used Moscow parks, and on this early spring day, with the snow off the ground and the weather warming, the park was particularly crowded. Ken knew crowds could be used to his advantage, allowing him to blend into packs of visitors, but they also served a similar function for KGB watchers. There was also danger in looking too closely at every person that crossed his way. Training and experience had taught Moscow personnel that if they looked hard enough, anyone could seem out of place. Since surveillance teams attempted to imitate everyday life, ordinary citizens can easily be mistaken for more than they really were. The old man wearing a cloth cap and walking slowly with a cane, the young couple strolling hand in hand along a path, a mother with children seeking a few hours' reprieve from a small apartment, or the stout middle-aged lady with the ubiquitous plastic perhaps bag swinging at her side, any one of them could be members of the Seventh Directorate. Then again, they could be just what they appeared to be, Muscovites enjoying a spring day outdoors. Ken was well aware of this particular operational paralysis. Intelligence officers called it seeing ghosts. The psychology of the phenomenon was rooted in the inherent anxieties of clandestine activity, coupled with the real possibility of encountering hostile security. What made it particularly vexing was the uncertainty of proving a negative. If one observed surveillance or heard transmissions over the monitor, it became a certainty. But if one did not see or hear surveillance, several possibilities came into play. There could be no surveillance, the officer had not identified surveillance, or surveillance could know where he was headed and be waiting there. To combat the uncertainties, Ken relied on confidence that previously effective SDR techniques would work again. In the end, it came down to trusting experience, training, and whatever technology was at hand. When well executed, the plans, maneuvers, and detailed routes that had been so carefully constructed, studied, and practiced should reveal surveillance, but ultimately Ken would act on his instincts. Even if his elaborate vehicular and foot SDRs did not reveal surveillance, Ken, like every other officer, had the option to abort the operation based on nothing more than gut feeling. You absolutely trusted the process, but at the same time, you developed an intuition about what was there and what wasn't, Ken explained. After a while, you began to get a feel for these things. Something might just not feel right. So, despite all the planning and preparation that came before, the final decision of go, no go was Ken's alone. With the park-goers bustling around him, he paused, took several deep breaths of the chilly spring air, and decided, it's a go. Entering an isolated section of forest, he quickly changed from his American clothes into the local clothing stuffed in the backpack. The Russian clothing offered a fair degree of camouflage by blending in among the other drably dressed Soviet citizenry. Soviet clothing, in 1981, had little of the style found in Western fashions. The outfit Ken now sported featured well-worn grays and browns, a brimmed fedora-like hat, inexpensive Russian shoes, a knee-length overcoat, and rough, ill-fitting trousers. He would not have looked out of place in a World War II film among the costumed extras who populated the set of a crowded train station. Casually draped on one shoulder was the rucksack with its unusual picnic supplies. Weighing nearly 35 pounds, it contained, along with his original clothing, a $20 million investment in advanced U.S. eavesdropping equipment designed to extract and record signals from lead-sheathed communications cables the Soviets considered tamper-proof. If discovered by the KGB, not only would the mission aimed at critical intelligence abruptly end, a technical collection capability that could be applied to similar targets in other parts of the world would be exposed. Walking through the groves of birch that bordered the park, Ken took a lengthy, circuitous route leading him out of the park and immersing him in Moscow's general population on the public transportation system. Changing buses several times, his face set impassively, Ken became indistinguishable from the other passengers. The trolleys and buses made their way through Moscow traffic, carrying him far from the manhole on Varshavskaya Chaussee, and then, eventually, returning him to within walking distance of the target. At each change of bus and trolley, Ken tried to be the last to step off and observe if anyone else was rushing to get through the closing doors. Still wearing the receivers, he listened for surveillance transmissions corresponding to his actions. Like the vehicular SDR, some elements of Ken's foot SDR were designed to compel improvisation by his KGB watchers, forcing them into the open by making mistakes. Other elements of the routine allowed him to pick out patterns or repetitions in surrounding faces. Was the young couple he noticed earlier in the park now getting on the bus far from where he first spotted them? Was it the same girl, only now dressed in a different coat and hat? Was the license plate of the car that trailed a respectable distance behind the bus the same one he had seen a half hour earlier? Ken followed the procedures, moving steadily toward the time when he would make the second crucial decision, entering the manhole. The right choice